Fraser Coast. I'm Jussie Lindeberg, your host. And today we're celebrating our 100th episode. And I'm here at a very special location. I'm with Lindsay Titmarsh. I've said your name right, haven't I, Lindsay?
That's it. That's a one.
Yeah, good. And I'm at his family property here on the Fraser Coast, where we're sitting on a cattle station, which pretty well overlooks the Mary River and also across to Fraser Island, at a property called Tandora. Thank you so much for welcoming me onto your property, Lindsay.
You're welcome. Anytime, Justine.
Oh, anytime?
Yeah, come back.
I'll come back Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. Come back.
I've contacted you, been put in touch with you, because I was looking for someone who's been in the Fraser Coast all their life and could share some stories of how things have changed. And you really tick all those boxes. How long has your family lived here at Tandora?
My grandfather came here, Justine, in 1907. Back in those days, it was a pretty wild sort of a place too. There's just bush everywhere and nothing cleared like it is now. And they arrived here on the 16th of December. Now, anyone that knows this coastal country will know that once you get into the summertime, you're in sandfly and mosquito territory. So they arrived from Ipswich on the 16th of December, which is right in the middle of sandfly country, landed at the house. No fly screens, no repellent. They arrived with three kids. Father's sister was 7, dad was 3.5, and his brother was 1 and a bit. And they landed here and they would have just got chewed alive because there's nothing to prevent the sand flies. So when we get visitors, they can't handle them. They just say, we're out of here and go home. Those kids were stuck here full time.
Nowhere to go.
Nowhere to go. That was it. Anyway, they must have made them tough. So they got out of it all right and got immune to them. And
so your grandfather wouldn't have gone on to realestate.com to find this property.
I don't think so. The reason he bought it was cheap coastal country. He was an inland, he worked on the cattle stations inland for most of his young life. And then he bought a dairy farm at Loamside below Ipswich. And the big 1902 drought, which is a Federation drought, record drought, just about broke him. Mum and my grandparents, they sold out and bought Tandora. The only reason they bought it because it was cheap, coastal country that not many people wanted. Mineral efficient country and the cattle didn't do any good, but Pop didn't know that. It didn't take him long to figure it out when he got here, but he didn't know it wasn't much good. So that's the reason why they would have came here. It was cheap.
And the home that they came to, is that the homestead that you're now renovating?
Still the same one, yep. It's had bits added to it and taken off and so forth, but it's still the same homestead that was here in 1907, and it wasn't new then. Now, my grandfather was the 5th owner of Tandora. He wasn't the first, he was the 5th. The first one was the White family. They stayed about 18 years and sold out. Then Dr. Gard bought Tandora. Now, anyone that knows the history of Maribyrnong will recognise that name. Dr. Gard was a celebrity in Maribyrnong. He went to Gallipoli, surgeon at Gallipoli. He had just about the first motor vehicle in Maribyrnong. First member of RACQ, I believe, just about in Queensland. He owned Tandora. It was only more or less a hunting estate, shooting ducks and quail and kangaroos and stuff. But he had cattle here, which would have just been a hobby sideline thing because he obviously been a doctor. He had an income from somewhere else. And he built the first cattle dip on Tandora, first concrete cattle dip in the Maribyrnong district. And we still use that same dip from 1903. We still use that cattle dip right now. He was a 3rd. Then we had Charlie Williams. He was a welterweight boxing champion of Australia. He only stayed about 18 months, or two years it was actually. Then he sold out to an aristocrat from England, Cecil George Doveton Sprott. Now, I believe that Mr. Sprott had an inheritance coming from England, so he sold out and went back home and claimed his inheritance. But I know why most of them couldn't handle it. The sand flies and mosquitoes would have just eaten them alive. So they'd be glad to get out.
Yeah, so are you saying if we were here on sunset, do the sand flies still come out now?
Oh, not this season, but summertime they do. Yeah. It depends on the weather. If you get a dark clouds overhead and no breeze, look out. When you get a nice breezy day, you don't take any notice, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just a weather-related thing.
Well, sitting here, it doesn't feel like a riverside setting. or a mangrove setting. We're on a cattle station.
Oh yeah, that's, yeah.
It's, so the, I didn't even consider that there may have been sandflies around here.
Oh, there's a few here.
Yeah.
But we don't take any notice. You get immune to them. The grandkids up the hill there, they just rub them off and keep going.
So you've got more than a few acres here. How big is Tandora?
We're 11,000 acres here, Justine. When my grandfather came here, he had 3,200 acres. And he paid £1,600, which equates to $3,200 in today's money. So he's actually paid $1 an acre for it.
Yeah.
$3,200 for 3,200 acres. So he paid a dollar an acre. And we extended it. My father brought it up to 5,000. Noel and I added a lease country on it. We freeholded that and got it up to just over 10. Then we bought a neighbouring property and got it up to just under 11. So that's where we're at the moment. About 2,500 head of cattle here, probably 2,400 at the moment, gets up to 2,500. We harvest grass trees off the bush part of the property. Been doing that for 26 years. So we sell grass trees all over Australia. That's where we're at.
Yeah, but I'm interested to hear about the mangrove. So your life has been spent on this property.
Yep, that's it, 72 years. Well, this is how it was. Now, back in the day when I was a young bloke, the mangroves were more or less classed as just a nuisance. If you went to chase pigs out in the paddock, they always raced straight into the mangroves for protection. So they were a nuisance because you couldn't get in there. The mangroves were too thick to get and chase the pigs. And if you went to drag a crab out of a crab hole, the sandflies chewed hell out of you. So we blamed the mangroves for that.
Yep.
So we didn't take much notice of them. But change a little bit now. You get silly as you get older. So.
But you've got a lot of knowledge around the mangroves. Oh, so on your walking tours, you must share the whole ecology and...
There's more in it than I ever thought. Now, a fella turned up here, Norm Duke, Professor Norm Duke. He was a, I don't know what he was actually, he was to do with mangroves with the Queensland Uni and James Cook Uni, and I got to know Norm, and I learnt more from him than anyone else ever could ever learn. He just knew, he's a world authority on mangroves, and I learned a lot from Norm.
So with you living in the Fraser Coast your whole life, what's your take on the changes that you've seen over three quarters of a century here?
Not that old, am I? I'm awful, I suppose.
You're not far off.
Yeah,
not. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
You still look pretty good for 72.
I don't know, I haven't got time to be sicker than me. Right, Hervey Bay. When I was a kid, we had 5,000 people in Hervey Bay. Now we've probably got 85,000, so the heck of a change there for a start. All the cane land around the bay is now Bunnings and it's, you name it, it's all gone into suburbia. And Maribor, it hasn't sort of grown like the bay, but it, in between it's all filling up with houses and stuff. So there's been some big changes. We went to St Helens School when I was a kid, and it's a little low block thing on the ground that the flood used to come into, and they lifted that up. There's been some changes.
Have you got any fear of suburbia creeping up onto your doorstep here?
No, not really.
No?
The kids want to be farmers, so they're not going to sell out to some developer.
Yeah.
Grandkids, I should have said, they want to be farmers.
That's awesome. And so how have you kept yourself so fit? And your memory, because you've got the memory of a...
Oh, I don't know about that.
You've got an amazing memory.
I don't know about that, but... Oh, I work 7 days a week, don't have any days off unless I've got to go somewhere. I'll never, ever sit on the veranda like we're doing right now. Never sit on the veranda just doing nothing.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. That's all right. I start at 5:45 this morning. I'll probably get home tonight at about 6 o'clock, so
yeah.
Doing that 7 days.
But it can't all be work. Do you do line dancing?
Oh, come on. No. Line dancing? Nala used to do it.
Yeah.
No, I can't do it.
And do you still ride horses?
No, it's all motorbikes and stuff.
Yeah.
And buggies and that. No, and we got a horse here, but no one used them. It's all modern stuff now.
Yeah. So tell me about what you're doing with your next project here that you've got at Tandora's.
The old house from way back 1907. Now, it wasn't new then, bear in mind. It was probably 30 years old then. We're renovating that right now for a farm stay operation. That means people can come and stay here and have a look around and throw a fishing line in and all that stuff. So that's happening right now. It should be finished before Christmas. And the old house will look good again.
Yeah, well, I've just had a walk through the house, and it's quirky, but it's beautifully being refurbished, brought back to to probably better than it's ever been, I would imagine.
It was pretty daggy there a while back. We didn't know whether to burn it down or pull it down or what, but it's coming up all right now.
Yeah, well, it's definitely worth another visit to come out and have a look at that. You're talking about this land, how when it was originally purchased, your grandfather didn't realise how bad the land was.
Mm.
Have you turned that around with your farming practices?
Now, when I was a kid, this is 50 years after my grandfather came here, Tandor was capable of running about 450 head of cattle. Back in the day, it was mineral deficient coastal country. And by mineral deficient, I mean all the wet seasons for millennia have washed all the nutrients out, leached it all out, so all you've got is poor coastal country left. And before fertilizer and improved grasses came into fashion, it was mineral deficient. The cattle didn't do very well at all. Now, we can get a calf out of a cow every year, more or less. Now, back then, it had to be every second year. You couldn't get a cow. She couldn't handle a calf every year because the nutrients weren't there. So we've cleared the country, plowed the old natural grass out, planted improved grasses, put fertilizer on, and now it's capable of running about 2,500 head, and that's where we're at. Now, since you mentioned fertilizer, people have bad dreams and stuff. We've got a system here. Now, bear in mind, it's flat country. We don't have any hills. Might have a little bit of a rise or a ridge somewhere, but no real hills. And we put superphosphate on every year or two. Now, the rule is never put it on during a wet season. Wouldn't even think about it. Now, some people must think that farmers just put fertilizer on so they can let it run in the river. Now, I can assure people that the amount of money we spend on it, we want every last drop to stay on the paddock. We don't want it to go on the river. We do everything possible to stop it from running in the water course. So the rule at Tandor is never put on during the wet season. Now, I'll tell you the reason why. If you put on when it's dry like now, we've just finished 2 days ago doing it. Country's reasonably dry. You get a shower or a storm, and the water soaks in, and it takes the fertiliser in with it. If you do it when the ground is saturated, and you get another deluge of rain, it just dissolves the fertiliser, and it can't soak in, it just runs away. So we must put it on during the dry weather, and you must have a grass cover. It's no good putting it on flogged out bare paddocks, because it'll run off as well. So you get a good grass cover with mulch and stuff underneath it, and dry weather, and it'll stay on the paddock. And that's what we do, and have done for ever.
So do you welcome people out here to come and look at Tandora?
We get bird watchers. Now, the veterinary students from Gatton College and James Cook in Townsville come here and do work experience. Now, they don't come here as work slaves. They come here to learn. Glenn, my son, teaches them all the secrets of cattle husbandry. We have a waiting list 18 months ahead. Students wanting to come here from all over the world. I think we've had 163 through here at the moment. They still want to come when this COVID thing fizzles out. So there's always someone here. The indigenous bachelor fellas from the bay bring the boys. They have worked secret men's business weekends at Tandora, where they bring the young fellas out and they go through the bush and along the rivers and stuff and teach them the old time, you know, stuff from way back. So they were here a couple of weeks ago. So there's usually someone around the place.
Can you eat mangroves?
Mangroves?
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure. Wild pig, they love them. Proper girls that fall off the certain variety of mangrove, the Abyssinia mangrove, the pigs just love them. Oh, I reckon they come from inland. I'm sure they come from inland during the season to feast on them. Now, back to the mangroves. When I do my mangrove tours, I take people on walking mangrove tours. Now, when I applied for the license, the Departmental of Lakes in Brisbane said no one's ever applied for one before, so we don't know what to do with it. No one's mad enough to do it up north because the crocs will eat you. And if you go down south of Maribor, the mangroves are really not worth looking at, so this is the spot. And we just walk out in the big open flats and thickets, and there's just special stuff out there, just really special stuff that you can't see in a boat. No one ever goes out there. Only the wild pigs live out that way, but people don't go out there.
And how long does your tour usually last for?
Oh, about 4 hours. We go out for about 2.5 hours, come back and have morning tea, and then go out for another short one on a different spot, and that's about it. I've never had a complaint yet.
Yeah.
No one ever says, oh, that wasn't worth looking at. So I usually ask the tourists, have you ever seen a a reasonable size mangrove. How big do they grow? Now, I don't mean in height, they never get high, but they get fat, big diameter. And people try to impress me, they say, oh, I saw one must have been in the old style about a foot diameter, might have been nearly 2 foot diameter. We have a mangrove here, 2.9 meters diameter. There's no gum tree in the Fraser Coast 2.9 meter diameter, so it's a massive tree. Another one up the river, it's only 2.4 diameter, and I got it carbon dated. It came back at 738 years old. And Professor Norman Duke, who I mentioned before, claims it's the oldest known mangrove in Australia. It's probably the oldest one ever been dated. Them could be older, but no one's ever found out, you know, how old they are. So he claims it's the oldest. Well, yeah, then I got a little Mary and Susan book, one of my books, and it features, I think there's 25 different species of crabs that I found in the Mary system. 25. Little ones, is, no, I'm not counting the big mud crab, they're just different. No, I'm talking about the little ones you see running around the mud and stuff. There's stacks of different sorts.
So you've got this wealth of knowledge just through the years living here on the property and a curious mind, but you've put all this, a lot of this information into a number of books.
The first one we wrote was for the centenary of my grandfather coming here, so that was 2007. So we wrote this big fat one that's got nearly 400 pages. It's called Tandora, A Pioneer's Dream. It's got a photo of my father on the front leaning over his bullock team. My mum came here in 1943. She wanted bananas. She always wanted to grow something. So it took the old boy about 3 years to get around to doing something about it. So about 1946, he ploughed an acre down the beside the river with his bullock team. Had no tractors, no machinery, just ploughed an acre with his bullock team. And mum planted bananas, and those same bananas are still there now, over 70 years later. They just keep suckering out, and you don't have to replant them. So those bananas are still there. So that was the first book.
I'm going to ask you a really dumb question. If you plant a banana fruit, does that become a tree?
No.
Oh.
You've got to plant the sucker. So you've got to get an actual... You've got to get an actual...
I did say it was a dumb question.
Yeah, well, they've got, actually got seeds in them. Those little white brown things.
Oh, in the banana.
Yeah, but I don't think they grow. I've never heard of anyone growing them. They might in
okay,
a
so
lab or something.
Okay, so don't plant a banana to grow a banana
no,
tree.
No, forget the banana. You've got to plant a sucker, which is an actual small tree.
Yeah. But somewhere, that must come from somewhere though, if you don't have a sucker.
Well, you can't grow them without, I don't know whether you can or not, but anyway, they were planted with suckers.
Yeah.
And they're still there after over 70 years.
So that book, Tandora, is that available for purchase anywhere?
Yeah, at that bookshop in Walker Street, on opposite the Shamrock Hotel, which is not the Shamrock anymore.
Okay.
Walker and Ferry.
Yep.
There's a little bookshop there, Walker Street News, and they... So that's a big Tandora one. Then we've got a... I did another one on Mary and Susan.
The rivers?
Yeah, Mary and Susan, yeah. It was just on the river systems and how they work. These river systems are not that simple. It's aimed at Mary Fitzroy. She was the wife of the governor of New South Wales.
Oh, and what about Susan?
Susan's named after Susan Colburn, who was a daughter of a police sergeant who went missing between Maribor and Brisbane. Now, when he went from Maribor to Brisbane way back, he didn't go down the coast. He went through Nanango back inland, and he went missing on a trip and was never seen again, so they named Susan River after his daughter.
Oh, wow.
That's how it came about.
How terribly sad.
There's a lot in this river system stuff. Now, most people wouldn't realise that when you go along the river, the foreshore of anywhere, where there are mangroves, and you can look along the line of the trees and you will see a distinct cut-off of the mangroves. There's never any stragglers way out in the past the cut-off line.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in a bush situation, a mainland situation, you might find a patch of trees, and besides then you'll see all the little ones starting to come up.
Yep.
You don't see that with mangroves. There's a distinct cut-off line. That line is mean sea level. That is halfway between the lowest low tide and the highest high tide. That is halfway in between, and Professor Norman Duke told me that a mangrove cannot grow even 2 inches below mean sea level. It's that critical. Right on the mark is the cut-off point. The reason being that a mangrove has to spend half of its time out of the water. If you dam the river here and put water full time in the mangroves, you'd drown a lot of them. They have to spend half their time out of the water. The reason being there's no oxygen in the river mud. It's just about totally devoid of oxygen. So to get their oxygen, the trees have to have exposed roots which have lenticels on them, which are just like little pores of your skin, and those trees breathe through those pores. So if they're permanently covered with water, they can't breathe and they die. You can drown a mangrove easy to them. So that is why you've got that distinct cut-off line. And the only reason you can extend that mangrove grove is by the mud has to build up to that mean sea level height. Can't be any other way. Has to get to that height before they'll go. So there's a fair bit in this system.
Yeah, I feel like this is opening a can of worms.
Yeah, well, there's more of them.
So, global warming.
Yep. When the sea levels rise.
Is that impacting on the mangroves?
It will. Now, the sea levels might have risen here at Tandoora, not much. Not much at all. But as it comes up, the mangroves are going to have to go back. They have to go back. The outside ones will die off and the new ones will start on the inside.
Mm.
Can't be any other way.
Yeah.
Now, if you work this out, the tidal levels around Fraser Coast, you don't get much, you don't even get a 4 metre rise from the lowest low to the highest high. So you've got less than 4 metres of tidal height. So if you cut that in half for the mean sea level, you have got less than 2 metres that a mangrove tree can grow in. 2 metres of elevation. If it's less than that, it'll drown. If it's more than that, it's up on the mainland. So all those mangroves in the whole system are growing on less than 2 metres of elevation. So if the tidal sea levels rise and the tides get higher, well, those trees are going to have to change pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Now, I'll run this past you, Justine. After the ice age, when the ice melted up and the glaciers up north, sea levels around the world rose by about 9 millimetres per year. So that's 90 centimetres per century. It's nearly 3 feet a century. So the mangroves must have had to adapt pretty quickly, because every 2 centuries, you've wiped out the whole population, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit in this mangrove system.
There's so much intelligence in the plants and animals on this planet that humans don't give credit to.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Well, as I say, like that. Now, that cut-off point, any other tree in the bush, if it's in a swamp, it'll grow forever if it's suitable. And if it's on a hill, it'll be right. But those mangroves cannot go below that cut-off point.
Yeah.
Not even... Well, now, this is a tidal situation. You'll see a mangrove growing in a swamp that's sort of sealed off and they just live there forever. But this is a tidal situation. They cannot grow below mean sea level.
Yep.
So there's a fair bit in it.
I think it's a wonderful thing to embrace your own environment and really get to know everything that you have around you.
And I'm still learning all the time.
Yeah, I bet you.
Learn all the time.
It's a good
all
way
the
to
time.
Be.
We have 10 varieties of mangroves here in the Fraser Coast. And now there's only 2 out of the 10 have actual seeds. Right, just a seed. The others have propagules, which are the long, thin things that stick in the mud when they fall off.
Yes.
So that's actually viviparous fruit, they call that. It germinates on the tree and it forms its root buds on the tree. Some of them are long, about 9 inches long, and before they drop off and spear in the mud. So that the actual trunk of the new tree forms while it's still on the tree.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yes.
So you've got the root buds on the bottom, you've got the trunk there, and you've got the first 2 leaves that come when it drops in the mud. They're ready to go. So that thing drops off, it floats around, it might float around the ocean for 2 months, washes up somewhere. Now, when they float in the salt water, which is more buoyant than fresh, those big long propagules float horizontally.
Yes.
That means they can drift all over the place easy. And when they get somewhere where maybe they can grow, and it's a wet season, the water is fresh, it's not buoyant enough to hold them horizontally, they turn vertical.
Uh-huh.
Which means they might be able to wriggle into the mud somewhere being vertical. So it's pretty complicated stuff.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how I've disrupted that process by picking them up fetch with my dog.
There's millions of them. It's like the tree seeds in the bush. Trees in the bush, you wouldn't get 0.1% ever germinate because there's millions of them.
Yeah.
There's not enough room for them.
Yes.
The only thing that overpopulates the world is people. Everything else is governed by food or some other natural, like the dingoes on Fraser Island when I was a kid. if you saw one dingo a month, you were doing all right. Not having walking around your car looking for a handout.
Mm.
That's not nature.
Yeah.
So that those things you pick up and throw around the beach, they got no chance of living once you're laying up on the beach. They're finished.
Yeah.
So don't worry about it.
Thank you so much.
Bye for that. That was all right anyway.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you. Ba-da-ba-da, 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 da 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 da